Hello, my name is Eva, and welcome to part four of the history of the Stockholm bloodbath of 1520. Last time we left off on the evening of the 7th of November, 1520. After years-long fighting, King Christian of Denmark had subdued his Swedish foes. He had seen his arch-enemy Sten Sture the Younger killed in battle, and he had, on the 4th of November, 1520, been crowned King of Sweden. The Swedish crown had been placed on his head by the Swedish Archbishop Gustav Trolle, whose life and machinations we covered in detail in the last episode. King Christian had, upon his accession to the throne, declared a universal amnesty for those Swedes who had fought against him as he attempted to conquer their lands. It had been the prudent thing to do immediately following the conquest, which in the early days of November was still rocky at best. But King Christian was a man of hot temper and possessed of vindictive nature. He was not a king to let his enemies get away with disobedience, let alone what he considered treason against his person. So just before noon on the 7th of November, 1520, 90 or so Swedish nobles were directed into the great hall of Trekorna Castle in the heart of Stockholm. Festivities on the occasion of King Christian's coronation had by that time been well underway for four whole days, and the nobles who gathered in the great hall undoubtedly thought that they had been invited to yet another round of feast and toasts. However, according to the contemporary witness accounts, armed guards suddenly appeared and stood before the great oak doors of the great hall and prevented anyone from leaving Trekorna Castle. A meal had been laid out in the great hall, but before anyone could partake of the sumptuous offerings, Gustav Trolle's voice rang out as he presented the king with a scroll filled with the names of knights, bishops, and nobles, all of whom Gustav Trolle accused of heresy by way of their theft of church land and not least the destruction of his bishop's villa way back in 1518. Why did Gustav Trolle present this accusation to King Christian? The easy answer would be that Gustav Trolle wanted to use the king's power to rid himself of his erstwhile enemies, who had stood in opposition to him in the years when Gustav Trolle fought against Viceroy Sten Sture's policies, which stood in opposition to the Danish king. Gustav Trolle was, as you will recall, pro-union with Denmark, while Sten Sture was fiercely anti-union. And now, on the eve of the Danish king's defeat of the Swedes and their fight for independence, Gustav Trolle pointed his finger at his enemies and declared them heretics. Gustav Trolle's accusation of heresy served King Christian very well, as an accusation of heresy allowed the king to pursue his enemies under the pretext of wanting to save their immortal souls rather than wanting to kill them out of personal revenge. The men and women on that list had all fought under the banner of Swedish independence. Some had actively fought the Danes. Some had funded those who fought the Danes, and others still had prayed for those who fought the Danes. And so, if, as Trolle claimed, that this was to be regarded as heresy, then King Christian had no choice but to punish the accused in accordance to the papal decree of 1235, in which the Pope himself, Pope Gregorius, had declared in no uncertain terms that a promise made to a baptized Christian was rendered null and void if that person turned out to be a heretic. So, King Christian would not be bound by his promise of amnesty should the accused be found guilty of heresy. So, as I said, Gustav Trolle's accusations of heresy served the king very well indeed. Gustav Trolle had written a document naming 90 or so accused, but initially he only put forward 18 names. These were all nobles who were directly implicated in the destruction of his bishop's villa 2 years back. These accused included Christina Julensteina, the widow of his archenemy, Steen Stoer. And on that evening of the 7th of November, it was Christina Julensteina who led the counter-arguments against Trolle, and she produced documents attesting to the fact that it was not only those 18 who had conspired against Gustav Trolle, but in fact, bishops, nobles, even commoners had all agreed back then in 1518 to depose the deeply unpopular Gustav Trolle. So the document she produced was meant to prove that the 18 nobles had not acted alone, but followed the will of state and people. Now, on that evening, the 7th of November, the 18 accused were confident that they would be acquitted, for it seemed so highly unlikely that King Christian would strike against the high nobility of Sweden. But they had reckoned without their host's ability for rash decisions. The 18 accused were detained in the castle for the remainder of that 7th November, and by nightfall they had been imprisoned in the heavily guarded castle towers. A few of the most vocal opponents were even put in chains, while two bishops amongst the accused were separated from the group, causing fear and uncertainty. King Christian's soldiers prevented any news leaking out to the public, who were only aware that yet another evening of feasting had continued well into the night. The next morning, the 8th of November, a hastily gathered council of 14 priests, led by Gustav Trolle, once again heard the testimony of the 18 accused. It soon became clear that the accused were in a far more perilous situation than first assumed. According to Olaus Petri, a contemporary chronicler who witnessed the entire events, the accused attempted to defend themselves politically, yet found it difficult to convince the council, who again and again questioned them religiously. It became painfully apparent that only one verdict was expected, and by the afternoon of the 8th of November, 1520, the Council of 14 arrived at a conclusion. The accused were guilty of heresy. Now, had the Council of 14 handled the proceedings as a purely religious matter, they might have meted out a sentence of public renouncement, perhaps even excommunication. That would have left the accused alive. Instead, they followed the custom of the Inquisition, such as the Spanish and the Italian, in which the accused, after having been declared guilty, were then handed over to the state authorities, who often exercised a sentence of death. Death was what King Christian had hoped for. Death was what he had always intended, and death would take center stage the following days. According to the historical work, the Swedish Chronicles, on the afternoon of the 8th of November, two bishops, Matthias and Vincent, were led from Trekrona Castle out into the largest city square in Stockholm, and there immediately beheaded by sword. Thus began the Stockholm bloodbath. Commoners miling about the city square were shocked by what they saw. The city criers stood in the square and proclaimed the guilt to all and sundry, yet no one outside the closed proceedings had had any idea that King Christian would move so quickly against the Swedish nobility. Yes, they had been his one-time enemies, but now they were his new subjects. Speed, however, would mark this calamity from start to finish. By the early evening of the 8th of November, the mayor of Stockholm had been hanged from the city's newly constructed gallows, while 15 nobles had been beheaded, alongside their servants, their vassals, their tenants. No one was spared. The document Christina Julenstierna had produced on the 7th of November, with the clear intention of exonerating the initial 18 accused by proving that their actions were based on popular consensus, well, this document was used against her with ruthless efficiency. For Gustav Trolle and the king argued that if more people had indeed been involved, then more people were indeed guilty. So Trolle and the Council of 14 Priests produced their own document, known as the Sententiam, and this publication named an additional 60 people claiming they were guilty of heresy for their crimes against the church and, by extension, treason against the king. These 60 people had all been present on the 7th of November. They had all been detained at the castle. They were all found guilty. They were all led out to the city square, and they were all either hanged or beheaded. Olaus Petri, the chronicler who watched it all, described how the blood of the dead flowed through the streets of Stockholm, mingling with winter's mud and cold rain. The bodies lay in the city square from the 8th to the 10th of November, with soldiers preventing anyone from removing the bodies under penalty of suffering the same fate. Finally, on the evening of the 10th of November, a bonfire was lit in the city square, and on it was thrown the bodies of 82 people. This number was recorded by the main executioner, Jürgen Humert, a vassal of King Christian. According to Jürgen Humert, a Danish priest who presided over the killings, absolutely refused to hear the last confessions of the accused. This was serious, for in the medieval world, dying without confession all but prevented the individual soul from entering heaven. So, as I have hinted at, the accusations may have been heresy, but the executions sprung from vengeance. And vengeance was exacted on the living and the dead. For the body of Sten Sture the Younger, who had died way back in early February of 1520, well, his body was dug up and also thrown onto the bonfire. Not all of the 82 people killed during the Stockholm bloodbath had been directly named as heretics by Gustav Tolle. Some were, as mentioned, servants of the accused. Others were caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. So while the executioner talked about 82, there have been speculations that the real number was perhaps 92 or 94. Sten Sture's widow, Christina Julensdiana, was one of the few accused who did escape death. In a highly questionable attempt at chivalry, King Christian allowed her to choose her own manner of execution. She had the choice of being burnt at the stake or buried alive. I mean, what a gentleman. Upon being presented with these two awful choices, she was said to have fainted, and it allowed her allies time to plead for her life. Ultimately, she was confined to prison under harsh conditions. King Christian himself would later boast of his clemency in allowing her to live, but hardly anyone in Sweden was actually listening to him. By Sunday, the 11th of November, an eerie peace had fallen on the city of Stockholm. In just 2 days, those of the Swedish nobility, who were known as the fiercest fighters, who were known as the richest landowners, and who were lauded as the most vocal of Swedes, they all lay dead, their ashes swirling in the cold, gloomy air which enveloped a city in fear. King Christian of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden relished that fear. It would keep his subjects in check and himself secure on the throne as he consolidated his grip on his three large kingdoms. But, as history has taught us again and again, there is a fine line between being absolutely numb with fear and being pushed so hard up against a wall that there is nothing left to lose by striking out. King Christian would discover this to his detriment. And so, next time, the aftermath. I hope you liked this episode. If you did, please consider subscribing to Restless Times in History. Until next time, I have been Eva, and thank you so much for listening.